Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe.
And I'm Justin.
And today we got a new segment for you. We're calling it What's New? Because we talk a lot on our leisure lists about stuff that's new and stuff that's old, and, well, let's just try to separate the new from the old from now on. And at the end of every month, we're going to try and do a wrap-up of what we saw in theaters, or books we read, or television shows, or just general movie news is going to be how we wrap up the last 20 minutes to half an hour of these things. So let's go into our medium shot and tell you what we're actually going to be talking about today. So we're going to be covering Novocaine, Black Bag, The Day the Earth Blew Up, a Looney Tunes movie,
And Marvel Rivals.
And Marvel Rivals. Not necessarily in all that order, but I've gotten smart and started putting time codes in the description, so you can figure out what you want to watch when you want to watch it, okay? And with that, let's get into our close-up and start with Novocaine, because you and I saw that together, which is a rarity, so gotta press the advance and get right into it. So Novocaine is Jack Quaid stars as a man suffering from SIPA and loneliness when the girl he's begun to date is kidnapped, leading him on an ill-advised quest to save her. So that is Novocaine. And you and I both were interested in this film right away because I went in expecting more of a stereotypical hit-the-ground-running action movie right away. And then the first 15 to 20 minutes of this thing really immerse you in the guy's ordinary world and builds up the relationship with the girl who ends up getting kidnapped. So you actually kind of care about this guy and the girl and what their lives were like before a robbery gone wrong happens.
Yeah, it was definitely a breath of fresh air for modern movies to be like, let's slow it down a bit so we actually have stakes instead of just going like a typical action movie where it's like, who cares about the setup? Just get into the action. No, it actually cared about its premise.
Which it was funny because at a certain point I was thinking, I know the action's coming, but I'm kind of invested in this thing just as like a rom-com sort of deal. Like I was just enjoying it on those terms.
Yeah, the bank heist comes in and I'm like, oh.
Okay, I guess we're into the action movie part now. Yeah. But as for the action parts, it's no John Wick, although I do see some inspiration from John Wick sort of style action in here. But as far as action goes, it's not the craziest thing I've ever seen, but it's more competent than I expected. And that's pretty big praise considering most action movies are just schlock. It just technically even bad. This one, at least, first of all, the action felt brutal. I thought the sound design especially brought that out. Every hit makes you wince. Ooh, that actually hurts. The squishing fleshy body parts and bashing on hard surfaces or sharps and slices and mutilations. You feel all of it. It's sound design that makes you empathetic with its main character, especially despite him not actually being able to feel any of it. And I also liked the way it was edited and blocked. It flowed really nicely. I got a great sense of geography and where everyone was at all times. And the match cuts were really well done too. Just, it's the little things. I'm like, wow, action I can follow. That's novel.
They did the John Wick style where it's like, okay, you can actually see what's going on. The camera movements are not jostling you where you're like, I don't know where I am yet.
Yeah.
And they made sure to, every single scene there was a fight in it. He went around the location first. We actually got a good feel for the space before the action really takes off.
That's a good call. I didn't really think about that myself, but you're right. He definitely, every location, they definitely did a walk around, for sure. Let's see. Going back to the beginning for a minute, I enjoyed how they set up visually his illness when, like, in his apartment in the morning. I can't remember the very first shot of the movie, but the second shot is him in the shower and he has to have this stopper or else he'll hit the hot water way too far and burn himself. And he's got tennis balls everywhere. Like, it really sets up just visually that he can't, like, they don't even get into the exposition about what his ailment is for quite a while until he goes on a date with the girl. But just visually and in his office space and in his apartment, we see all these safety mechanisms that he's set up for himself because he won't know if he even bumps into the corner of a desk. So he's got tennis balls on the corners, and which is kind of funny because the whole movie is, well, it starts off with him saying how his parents kept him in a bubble because the life expectancy for someone with SEPA is under 25. And he grew up, basically, his parents were very overprotective and he's not even allowed to eat solid food. The first time his girlfriend makes him try pie, he's like, wow, this is what pie tastes like.
And they did a really good job setting his character up for that, you know, using the visuals, but also there were more cues with it, like just how routine his routine is. Like, he starts every day with the alarm clock and he makes, you know, you get a feel just from the way it was shot. Like, it's like, okay, he probably makes this smoothie every single day. And, you know, his drive to work, he left that the gap, you know, he plays by the rules too. Like, he's very safe. He's very routine.
He can't even wait more than 3 hours without going to the bathroom because his bladder might burst. He needs to set a timer for that. Be regular, be on a very strict schedule that way, which, because they set up that ordinary world so well, it really feels like Whiplash when he decides, oh, okay, I'm going to, like, normally I would not be an action hero type, but I care about this woman and no cops are on the way and I see where the bad guys went. So if I don't go and go after her, they're probably going to lose her. And then at a certain point, I mean, you could say it gets a little bit ludicrous. This guy who's been safe his entire life suddenly turns into an action hero. But it's also, I like the way the movie added that element of the police think he was in on the caper as an inside job. So that's why at a certain point, he tails the bad guys up to a certain point, and then he can't trust the police anymore either. So he figures, okay, I guess I'll just keep going with this.
Well, in a way, it made me feel like it was almost like not really a parody because it wasn't like directly making fun of action movies, but
it's very heightened.
It kind of was making fun of action movies where it's like, oh, you know, most action movies, it's like, where are the cops? Why aren't the cops stopping this guy who's shooting people? And it's like, this one is like, no, the cops actually show up. And they're like, what are you doing? You can't just do this. And I think that to me was kind of felt like it was a main point to it too, was that, you know, in action movies, all the action guys, they're like, oh, Keanu Reeves gets shot with a bullet. He just walks it off. You know, I'm super tough. No. This guy actually can't feel anything. So he's just like, you know,
but I do like that. Despite him not being able to feel anything, his body does take damage. And it gets to the point later in the movie, he's literally just rotting on shots of adrenaline he took. That's the only reason this guy can stay standing after the damage he's taken.
That's what I mean. They went more realistic with it to the point where it's like, how could we do something similar to like a John Wick action movie, but, you know, make the guy actually realistic? Like, John Wick should be dead at this point, you know? But Novocaine's like, oh, you know what? This guy's running on actual, like, he's taking adrenaline shots. He knows he actually has his medical knowledge. And the only reason he keeps going is because he literally can't feel the pain.
I also liked how, for realism's sake, going back to that, he was mostly taking damage to his extremities, mostly to his hands and arms and legs. He never really took head or core injuries until the third act. So he was just, he couldn't feel pain and he wasn't taking injuries bad enough to like stop his musculature from moving. So he, or like bones breaking or anything. So the injuries he was taking were realistic enough, along with his injury. And like you said, his own medical knowledge, because he knows his ailment and the limits of himself pretty well, that I wasn't really taken out of it. And okay, well, now it's going way over the top. The biggest hurdle you have in this movie is believing that this guy who basically just had a one night stand would start risking life and limb for her.
But they set it, up though really well with the, like, you know, the guy he's helping at the bank where he works was great for that, because it set up that idea that he's like, you know, he was like, I would have, he lost his wife. And he's like, I would have felt the same if I lost her on day one, you know.
Yeah.
They set up this love at first sight connection that's so powerful, and then apply it to the main character now. And then it's,
you see their chemistry. She's not just the girl he had a crush on. You actually get to see what their relationship looked like for a while in a normal way, which I appreciated. The only thing I really think knocked this movie down a couple of pegs was its acting and the dialogue, which there were a lot of good scenes of writing. I like basically everything with Novocaine himself, with Jack Quaid and Novocaine, specifically that scene in the tattoo parlor when he's trying to suss out some information. Like, there are clever scenes in this movie, but I feel like all the other supporting actors were just dealt super generic dialogue, and a lot of the acting I thought was a lot of people were really hamming it up, specifically the bad guy.
Yeah, the bad guy was going over the top. The female lead was pretty good though, I thought.
Yeah, she was good on the whole. Jack Quaid was the biggest standout, and everybody else looked relatively weak next to him. Nobody extra impressed me except him.
I mean, the two cops had a vibe too. They were kind of playing the comedic relief in a way, which kind of found a balance. But you're right, everybody's kind of hamming it up a little bit. But I thought it played off nice. I mean, it's not supposed to be a straight action movie. It is sort of a parody of action movies, somewhere between a parody and a pastiche. I'm not sure where it lies, but
yeah, I think that's really my only gripe with it, was the dialogue and the acting besides Jack Quaid. But even then, it's not like bad. It's just okay. Well, it could have been better. Otherwise, I thought it was a really interesting premise, well executed.
And I like that they stuck to the premise even throughout the action. Like, it's like, okay, how is he gonna solve this with our premise in mind that he can't feel anything? And they kept to the premise the whole time, which I really liked that part.
Yeah, it's also a tight hour and a half, I believe it was. You know, it got in, got out, didn't overstay its welcome.
Especially taking its time to kick off, like,
yeah,
you know, they use their time so well, even though they used a lot of time to build it up. I think if it was any longer, it would have kind of overstayed its time. It was pretty much the perfect runtime.
It was in the pocket.
Yeah, it was definitely there.
So I don't know what you'll give it, but I'd say Novocaine's worth a watch.
Yeah, worth a watch, definitely.
So I'll do another one, and then you can do Marvel Rivals. So I watched Black Bag, which got a criminally bad marketing campaign because I never heard of it before about a week ago. Somebody, a YouTube reviewer I follow, just casually mentioned it in one of his videos, and I'm like, oh, this sounds interesting. I'll check that out. So, Black Bag is a British secret agent discovers that some of his co-workers may be committing treason, including potentially his wife. So, that's Black Bag in a nutshell, which the entire thing is effectively a game of cat and mouse between this guy who has a legendary prowess for telling when people are lying. And he's got these five co-workers, including his wife, among them. And he's basically trying to suss out who's the one committing treason. And there's
So it's not like there's only one, so it's kind of a mystery, or?
Well, he doesn't really know. It could be all of these five. It could be some of them. They're just the list of suspects that he has to figure out, okay, so what am I dealing with here, including the woman I share a bed with? Is she going to... But like that, the reason it's called Black Bag is because of all the secrets these people keep from each other. They say, okay, well, kind of the reason us secret agents are dating amongst ourselves is because we have a built-in excuse for any time we want to keep things hidden. You ask me something I don't want to tell you, I say black bag, and they'll say, okay, I know you can't talk about that. It's a black bag problem. So that's why you can't really tell any, like, all these people who are dishonest for a living. Everyone mutually knows they can't trust each other. But Michael Fassbender is the main character, and his thing is he really hates liars specifically. And there's a difference in his mind between, okay, you can't tell me what you're doing for work purposes, and then there's you're full on committing treason and lying to me about it, and it's not just because you can't tell me. He really wants to believe that his wife is... He starts to believe that she's just in trouble and has a good reason that she can't tell him about it, but that's just what he wants to believe. He also really doesn't know until he starts investigating these things. So it's them and their other friends. And I think as far as spy movies go, it's not in the vein of James Bond or a Mission Impossible. This is a very dialogue-driven movie. There's really long scenes of dialogue. Basically, all of it is like a series of really long dialogue scenes where these characters are playing mind games with each other or discovering new pieces of information to connect the puzzle. It's slow burn, so you got to have a lot of patience with it, but it really all pays off when you stick with it. I also enjoyed the editing in this movie because, like I said, the dialogue scenes are long, but the cutting is measured, and the way it's filmed too has a lot of long shots to show everyone's body language and some objectivity, because you're kind of in the point of view of Michael Fassbender's lie detector guy. You're kind of watching everybody else too to be like, okay, are they lying or what? Because you have no idea either. The movie sets everyone up on equal footing. They're all colleagues, they all know each other, but who's not telling the truth in this situation?
So would this be a movie that is still works on like a rewatch, or?
I think so. Yeah, definitely. Because you can start seeing who was hiding what and why. If you start seeing it from the other perspective, it makes sense in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone to a certain extent knows, everyone's got a piece of the puzzle, effectively. Michael Fassbender just has to figure out who knows which pieces of the puzzle and what's actually relevant here. And one tool I found, and I want to see if this counts on rewatch, is the way the colors and lights work in this movie. The cinematography was very weird. I might argue it was distracting, the choices they made, because the characters are consistently in darkness or the least lit thing in the frame. Basically every single frame, it looked like it was lit diegetically, which I doubt it was, but it looks like whatever light source is in frame is what's lighting the scene. And that light is the brightest thing in the scene, usually turning the characters in the scene darker. And not that they're out of focus, but I thought it was an interesting commentary, which I assume it's a commentary on the fact that these people exist in the shadows. But what I thought was interesting, and this is what I need to see a rewatch for, was I started convincing myself that the few times in the movie you could actually see people's faces very clearly or very clear lighting, that was when they were being their most raw and honest. And the darker people were, the more they were being untruthful, I started noticing a correlation between how much light was hitting you and how truthful you were being to a certain extent.
Well, it's definitely not diegetic light.
I doubt it.
Because to get clear, darker footage, everything has to be bright. So this is very intentional.
Well, it was very, very bright. I mean, it...
No, but I mean, even the shadow sections of a film on a film set will be bright.
Yeah.
Because if you film darkness, you get grain in the darkness. So their faces would be, you'd have an extreme amount of grain, basically.
Yeah, there was this weird pulsating light thing throughout the film, which it just looks like if you film light when it makes it look weird on camera, which, you know, obviously they were going for a choice. I just found it a bit distracting because the light source is always the brightest thing in a scene.
It sounds like thematically correct, but it's because something thematically is correct and sort of works doesn't mean it looks good. It definitely sounds like it could be distracting, for sure.
It was distracting. That's why I was watching it trying to figure out what the purpose behind it was, because I thought to myself, oh, well, you know, this movie doesn't look great, so what's going on here? And then I went into my review brain, and one great tip I heard about making reviews in the past is don't assume it's a mistake. Assume it was intentional. You can choose to dislike the choice. But I start thinking to myself, okay, but why did somebody choose to do this? And these are the answers I have come up with. I'm curious if you see it, what you would think. But yeah, so the dialogue scenes, like I said, are very long, but the dialogue is smart. The whole thing is basically spies trying to be coy with each other the entire time. And like I said, you're trying to figure out certain lines of dialogue provoke reactions. You're looking at their facial expressions and their body language and figuring, okay, what did you have to do with this? And what is Michael Fassbender saying to provoke you a little bit? Like, one of the best scenes is in the first act when he gets everybody, all the suspects, around a table for a dinner party. And he says, okay, so we're gonna play a game. And everyone knows this guy is kind of into mind games. So he says, okay, so we're gonna do like a New Year's resolution sort of thing. I resolve to, except we're gonna say it about each other to the person to our right. So I would say, I'm Justin. If I'm being Justin in this, I would say, I resolve to play Marvel Rivals less. For example, but like whatever the person chose starts throwing tension at the table, because I would say something like that to you, and then you'd be like, well, I don't play Marvel Rivals that much, but
I get it. Okay.
But you got to pick a resolution for the person next to you too. So you go all around the table and people's dirty laundry starts airing out. And like, that's very early on in the movie. Is him trying to gauge emotional reactions out of people.
That's a fast way to make a messy scene. Holy.
It ended a little bit bloody. But it was... Yeah. So... Yeah, I think the only thing is a certain type of person needs to watch this. You need to be okay with a very slow burn kind of movie. A lot of people will get bored early on. But I really think it's one of those, if you accept a slow burn, dialogue-driven movie and don't mind the distracting cinematography, it does pay off, and it's pretty darn good as a spy movie. I was very impressed by it. So, Marvel Rivals.
Marvel Rivals, yeah. So I've been playing Marvel Rivals. We're in season 1.5 now. I really like this game. It's fun. It's 6 versus 6. You've got all your kind of obscure Marvel heroes and, you know, ones you know as well. Each character feels very unique from another. There's a couple that are kind of similar, but if their kit is similar, it's usually only one. There's another character that's fairly similar. But other than that, for how big the roster is of characters, It's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You got to learn every different character. Like, you got to learn quite a few different characters to make things work, because these teams of six, different characters are better against different combinations, and you have to kind of learn those combos to figure out, which way can I break this? And the teams they don't want you to stay as one character the whole round. They want you to switch. They want you to adapt. So learning multiple characters is pretty much a requirement.
Okay. So how many characters roughly are in this game?
There's like 10 healers, and that's the smallest list. There's probably like 15, maybe 20 duelists, and maybe 15 tanks. I don't know. It's somewhere between the range of like 30 to 50 characters.
You told me some of the characters featured in this game before, where even I, as a self-proclaimed fan of superhero comic books, am like, I have never heard of these Marvel characters. I'm sorry. I have no idea.
Yeah, some of them are obscure. You're just like, I don't know who this is, but I'm going to learn to play them because they team up with somebody else. Like, I find the characters that would be less popular because they're not known as well, they've paired them up this season with characters who are more popular. Like, Luna Snow is the one that you were like, I don't know who that is. She's paired up with Moon Knight. So Moon Knight's an obvious choice. You know, a lot of people really like Moon Knight. He's a pretty popular character, and yeah, he's a very good in the game. And that's really boosted Luna Snow's numbers too. And a lot more people have tried playing her because it's like, oh, we got Moon Knight. Well, you know, if so many people are playing Moon Knight, maybe you should play the one, because the pairings are very powerful sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like an overall damage boost. I can't remember if it's that one, but some of the pairings are like, oh, you know, you get a 15% healing boost is the passive thing. And there's usually an active for the other characters that are in the set as well. But so those pairings, I've noticed they really push to try characters that aren't as popular.
Which I like. They update with new characters every so often too, don't they?
Yeah, they just brought in Fantastic Four.
Makes sense. Movie's coming out in a couple months. They want to cross-promote.
Definitely, definitely. And they're quickly becoming some of the more popular characters. I know for a fact that they added... I think they had Thing and Human Torch already, but they added Invisible Woman and Reed Richards. So they're both of those characters, I can see a rework coming in before season two, like when season two rolls out in like two more weeks, I think. And I can definitely see them reworking Mr. Fantastic, because he is currently the lowest rated character. He came out at the beginning of season one. There was season zero was first. So technically this is the second season. But so he was the first character, new character release, season one. So he's been out for a while. Invisible Woman came out at the halfway mark. She's extremely popular right now. Mr. Fantastic is like dead last, worst character in the game, not even worth playing.
Powers are hard to make work.
Yeah. I mean, if you get the right player, he's pretty powerful, but he's almost like... There's characters who can do the same thing, but better. Like, Groot has about the same range for his attack. When you play a tank, they try to limit how wide your attacks can go. So Mr. Fantastic stretches his arm, while Groot does the same thing. And Groot is just a better tank overall. He's got more features that keep him alive. Mr. Fantastic can be a pain, but I think it's just people find he's not worth playing over the other characters. To take him down is not hard if you switch to the right character, right?
And I'm sure listening to Groot's dialogue is far more riveting.
Yes, it is. It's very entertaining.
Yeah, that's one thing I've heard about Marvel Rivals, is the interactions between the characters, especially for fans of the comics. It's, oh wow, I didn't expect to see these characters interact, or okay, that's an interesting back and forth you guys had there.
Yeah, well, you catch different things too. Like, there's like an Iron Fist dialogue. I don't know who it was with, but I caught that. It's somebody who knows Iron Fist, and they're like, well, you're not the Iron Fist. And he's like, well, I am now. And I guess the Iron Fist in the game is not the one most fans are familiar with.
Yeah.
So that was interesting too. Like, you get little interactions like that, and every one of the characters is from like a different universe. Some of them are from the same universe. Some of them know each other. Some of them, they're not exactly, you're not my version of you, or some things are different, right?
Yeah, well, so you said the gameplay in this game is pretty fast paced, right?
It's definitely fast paced. Like, your duelists have not a lot of health. It's pretty fast to die. When you stun somebody with a stun, it's like one, two, they're back. It's, you got a couple seconds at most to react with stuff. And it definitely keeps things moving very quickly.
So what keeps you coming back to this game? Because I know for me, live service games are just, I start feeling the grind pretty quickly, and I just can't justify doing the same gameplay loops over and over and over again.
It's just, well, the different combinations of all the heroes, and I think that's why they rotate which team-ups work together, is because you get to see more combinations of teams, you get to see more combinations of power, see how things work together, what works against other things. So because the roster's so big, like, how many different sets of six can you make out of that versus another six, right? Yeah. And then you throw in the fact that there's different team-ups, and then every 2 months, they rotate the team-ups, and, you know, the whole thing shifts. Like, right now, I know the big pivot was they wanted to make Magneto cool, because he's a great character. He just didn't have anything that made him very powerful, so they teamed him up with Scarlet Witch this season, and it's an extremely popular combination.
Father-daughter combo.
Yeah, so it's very cool, but it's all those combinations. Like, you can never learn everything about this game. It's just not possible. I mean, you could if you played a lot, but by the time you've played that, it's going to rotate and it's going to change again.
From what you told me about all these dozens of characters, it's a very impressive level of design which goes into each one of them to make them feel... Yes, of course, they all have their roles to play, but every one of them seems to have a unique flavor within their set. And between the dialogue writing and the power sets, it seems like it's a lot of love and care put into this.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. I'm not sure how well that will stick with, because they had a team in China doing a lot of the base code and the voice acting and the story writing, and a lot of that was done in the States. And like last month or something, they were like, okay, we're closing up the American
division. One.
So I'm not sure how much of that would carry over. Maybe they've got a lot of stuff prepped in advance. Maybe. Is what...
I'm surprised they shut it down though, because the game's doing pretty well and only seemingly getting more popular.
Yeah, but if you think about it on a business sense, if the game's made already, they don't need them anymore. If they can do all the if the other division can do all the background coding and running the game and running the servers and rebalancing things, you don't really need the other team. The creative team doesn't really need to be there.
I guess not. Because
the base of the game is already built.
Well, it's brutal, but it's business.
Yeah.
So what would you give this game as a rating if you had to pick some?
I don't know. I'd probably say right now I'm feeling like it's a 7 out of 10, maybe an 8 out of 10. It's for what it is. Not like if you're comparing it to other games of different... Like, you can't compare games within like external genres, but... Within the genre of the kind of the looped gameplay, It's pretty good. It's not bad. Pretty enjoyable.
Closest kind of comparison, which isn't even close for type of game, but probably something like Marvel Ultimate Alliance, which is just, it, from my childhood, just from the sheer number of characters you could play, all which played uniquely, and you could do the different combinations. But that was more of a, okay, we're running missions and actually playing as these characters instead of, you know, the classic Stan Lee and Jack Kirby heroes fighting each other sort of thing. That's very in line with Marvel tradition. They've been doing that for 60 years. That was always Stan Lee's thing, was he liked seeing the heroes fight each other. So, good to see the tradition staying alive.
It's kind of the same thing, like, why that game would be replayable was because there were so many heroes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I watched The Day the Earth Blew Up, a Looney Tunes movie. So, in this film, Daffy Duck and Porky Pig must thwart the threats of an alien invader and their bubblegum-themed plot.
When did this come out? Oh, this is new.
This is new, yeah. It came out a couple weeks ago.
I didn't even hear about this.
Yeah, so here's what happened. And I'm going to get more into this when we start getting into the news section. But basically, Warner Bros. Didn't want to release this movie. And so another really small distribution company took it on. Warner Bros. Finished the movie. But you know how Warner Bros. Has been lately with movies they finished and then just kind of discard. So this is another one of those. But another distributor saved it and released it theatrically. But of course, being a smaller distributor, they didn't have the budget for marketing very well, which is interesting because this is the very first fully feature film 2D animated Looney Tunes movie in the 80 years of these characters. I've read that there have been compilation films with old shorts stitched together with some frame tales. They've had, you know, your Space Jams are back in action. You've had live action cartoon hybrids, but they've never done an hour and a half feature film that's fully animated.
I would have never guessed that.
In a classic hand-drawn 2D style.
Oh, really? That's cool.
I believe this was hand-drawn.
I mean, it's probably digital hand-drawn.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
That's the equivalent today. You know what? Digital drawing is essentially hand drawing to me, at least.
Yes. Animated using 2D hand drawn animation, not CGI. Hmm. So it's going back to that old classic style, not just in visuals, but in feeling too. It's got that old Looney Tunes slapstick humor. Just very intricate animation designs and some things too. The music was great too. The score drives a lot of the plot and very well underpinned the emotional moments too. And you know, they never planned for this movie to be huge, right? Because of the very premise of it. Of, wow, so you're going to do the first Looney Tunes feature without Bugs Bunny. Or any of that. This movie is just Daffy Duck and Porky Pig. They are the stars of it. It's not a shared universe, necessarily, with other Looney Tunes characters. It's an hour and a half movie about Porky Pig and Daffy Duck.
Wow.
And that's it.
That's brave.
Yeah. I mean, I think the alien bad guy in it looked semi-familiar, but it wasn't Marvin the Martian. But I feel like I've seen that kind of design in Looney Tunes before. It was like a tall, skinny,
yes,
bulbous head alien.
I know what you're talking about.
I'm not sure if Petunia Pig is a character. Maybe she's a newer one that I don't... She may have even been made for this movie, for all I know. But she's the main female character and Porky's love interest in the movie. But yeah, you see what I mean, though. It's not like there's no Sylvester and Tweety or Bugs or Elmer Fudd or any of that. It's just Porky and Daffy and a couple side characters.
making their B-listers and hoping to God they can make something out of it.
Yeah, which they did, because this movie had a pretty strong emotional undercurrent to it, I thought. The whole thing is basically, so Porky and Daffy in this version, they grew up together since childhood, and this old human farmer raised them on the farm, Farmer Jim. And then Farmer Jim leaves them his farmhouse and says to take care of it and stick together always. But then they let the place become dilapidated, and they're in the middle of the suburbs now because the farm got, you know, everyone built around the farm in the suburbs. And then there's a homeowners association lady who just desperately wants this place to get torn down because it's an eyesore in the neighborhood. And after a very, well, the aliens started coming to Earth and it knocked their roof down, and that's why they failed the inspection. So now they got to raise enough money to fix the roof, and they have to get jobs for the first time in their lives. So it's a lot of, like, basically Looney Tunes style shorts of Daffy Duck and Porky Pig trying different jobs until they finally settle on one that they're good at, which is at the bubblegum factory. But that's kind of the day the Earth blew up. That's part of the pun, is it's a bubblegum theme plot that the alien is trying to enact with the rollout of this new bubblegum product. So, yeah, there's a lot more dramatic elements in this movie than I expected from a Looney Tunes movie, and a shocking amount of body horror. There were some scenes where I'm like, oh, this is actually downright horrific, what they're presenting here, and the way it's animated, it's actually kind of scary in some sections, which I appreciated just for being different.
Who's this film aimed at?
I don't know, to be honest. It's probably kids. Probably, but like, not little kids, because it's, there's a lot of adult elements in it. I'd say probably like 12, 10 to 12 is what they're aimed at, but it works for adults too, because there's a maturity there you don't see in movies for little kids. A lot of it really comes down to the brotherhood between Daffy and Porky, and because they're such very different types of personalities, and that's where all the drama comes from, is Porky Pig is this very prim and proper kind of guy. When you see their sides of the room, like, his is very made up and everything, and then Daffy's just a complete basket case, free for all. Everything is a complete mess, and like, everything they're doing, they've been taught to stick together their whole lives, but Daffy messes up every situation for them because, you know, cartoon violence and craziness. He just can't keep still or keep his mouth shut. Makes him look crazy. And Porky's just got to keep his patience the entire movie to just not blow up on his brother. And then he starts getting a crush on this other pig in town and starts kind of driving a wedge between his relationship with Daffy. And then an alien invasion plot on top of that. So the day the Earth blew up, sad it didn't get more marketing, but definitely thought it was worth a watch. It was funny. I mean, I only laughed out loud a couple of times, but it was, you know, I had a big grin throughout. It was just, it was amusing. It's a good hour and a half Looney Tunes story. Which segues me nicely into what I was teasing before about all this Warner Bros. Looney Tunes drama. So I don't know how much you've heard about this, but the new, I don't know if he's the owner or what, the head honcho guy of Warner Bros., David Zaslav, who's been very famous the last couple years for fully scrapping films that they've completed as tax write-offs and gutting the studio from the top down to save a couple bucks, because I guess the studio was in a very bad financial way, and he's the guy who's going to be slicing all the fat off, even stuff people don't want to see gone. But he makes weird decisions. And his handling of the Looney Tunes brand has been rubbing a lot of people the wrong way. Because The Day the Earth Blew Up wasn't the only Looney Tunes movie he canned being finished. There was another movie called Coyote vs. Acme, which was supposed to be from what I've seen of it, it seems to be some kind of legal movie. Another live-action cartoon hybrid about Wile E. Coyote. Which, okay, cool, you were making Looney Tunes movies. You made The Day the Earth Blew Up, and you made Coyote vs. Acme, and then you canned them both. There is apparently still some hopes that a third-party distributor is going to save that one as well. But, so they did that. They made a couple Looney Tunes movies, and then they canned them. The second one that got people upset was they recently removed all the original Looney Tunes shorts off HBO Max. All the ones from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. They still have the Looney Tunes shorts they made from the 90s to present, but they got rid of all the classic ones. And from what I've read, the reasoning behind that is they're trying to rebrand HBO Max for adults and families and less for kids. And then some people pointed out the hypocrisy of that, saying, well, wait a minute, if you're trying to rebrand for families and not for kids, and the Looney Tunes shorts you're keeping include the most child-focused ones of them all, like, they're like, you kept something like baby Looney Tunes, but also you're not trying to market to kids, and you take off all the classics, which had humor arguably better suited for adults. I mean, I loved those as a kid, but I love them even more now when I watch them.
That's the thing, is the audience would be returning people who want to watch these and relive their childhood again. So that would be very adult themed, or like, you know, parents who want to show their kids this, like the old one.
Chad, right? Just the other week he was telling us he was showing his kids those. So that's not to say, I don't think they're getting rid of them entirely. People do expect them to crop up on somewhere or other on the internet. You know, they're so ubiquitous, you can't erase them the same way as other things, but they're not going to be housed on HBO Max, which is Warner Bros. Platform.
So it's not going to be anywhere in an official capacity, basically.
No, which is very strange. And people say, what the heck are you doing? I've seen people point to, there was a solid chunk of time there where, like, when you watched a movie, the Warner Bros. Logo had Bugs Bunny walking out and eating a carrot. Like, he's kind of the studio's mascot, if anything, for the last 80 years. Those cartoons are a lot of the bedrock of that studio. They're some of the most famous things they've done, especially those classics. And they're just kind of ignoring that legacy and trying to minimize it. Oh, and then the final nail in the coffin that's really making people mad after all this is they're tearing down the Looney Tunes building on the Warner Bros. Lot, which was apparently a classic building where they made a lot of these things. So basically, in a figurative and literal sense, David Zaslav is trying to kill the Looney Tunes brand. Between the content they're making, the classic content, the place, legacy buildings where some of the stuff was made on their lot, they're just trying to crush it.
Get it? I don't know why they don't just sell. If you don't want something, sell it. That's it.
Yeah. I saw this comment on Reddit the other day, which made me laugh. People were like, why is Zaslav doing all this? And the one guy said, a tune killed Zaslav's brother. I'll take that as the best explanation I've got,
I guess,
for this one-man crusade against Looney Tunes.
That is some weird decisions.
Apparently, also, another thing I saw they did was Warner Bros. Also, a couple years ago now, killed Cartoon Network's website.
Yes, and they did, yeah.
Yeah, and they pivoted that to redirect to HBO Max. So it's not just a crusade against Looney Tunes, but they're really slicing animation just in general, which frankly seems to be a worrying industry trend across the board, but all this stuff with Warner Bros. Is just happening within the last month, and it's very pointed, especially with a Looney Tunes movie that just came out. So that particular brand's been in the news. But, you know, forget an important legacy animation brand. Good luck getting any new animation off the ground in today's climate either. It's just kind of a bad all-around state for animation people right now.
Yeah, that's definitely seems really weird.
Yeah. Well, maybe there will be updates next month, but that's what's happening.
Well, maybe Warner Bros. Will go out of business and somebody will have bet against it and made a ton of money.
Maybe. Short the stock.
It's not the first time. They proved that GameStop, they were trying to short them like crazy. Intentionally, they were bringing down the company from inside. There's a whole lawsuit thing going on right now in the background that's like, Okay, you're trying to crush this company intentionally to make money. Yeah. So they basically, the new CEO got in, he literally bought so many shares that he's like, I am going to be the CEO of this company. And he got rid of everybody. They lost a lot of money doing it, but the company's still alive now.
I see. For now. I see.
But there's a history of doing that with using the stock market to intentionally crash a business and make tons of profit on it. And basically all the retail investors, the little guys, are the ones who lose.
Yeah, that might be what they're doing.
It's blatantly in your face, way too obvious that's what they're doing, but
I got no inside track, but their string of very questionable business decisions. Well, okay, I shouldn't say they're questionable from a business perspective. I don't know that world very well, but they're very questionable as a consumer. I love a lot of Warner Bros. Classic library and IPs, and to see them treat them so poorly for apparently no good reason boggles the mind. And speaking of classic IPs being treated very poorly, let's talk a bit about the Snow White debacle that's going on right now.
I heard it was good.
I've heard some people say it's not as bad as you expect. Other people say, I gave it a shot and it was as bad as I feared. There seems to be very little in the way of being in the middle on this discourse. What I will say is, having not seen it, I almost guarantee you it does not deserve a 1.6 on IMDb.
Is that how low it came now?
It's one of the worst rated movies ever on that website.
That's just review bombing, basically.
Look, same thing happened with Velma, which I know the internet loves to hate that show.
It's good.
It's not a 1.0 or whatever it was on IMDb. It's not that bad.
It deserves a 5 at least. Maybe even a 6 because it makes me laugh.
We didn't get through season 2, but season 1...
Well, that's because there's better things to watch. But that's why it's a 5 or a 6 star. But it's not a 1 star. It's not that bad.
Yeah, that's our hot take, is we actually kind of enjoyed the first season of Velma.
This is how we lose the entire rest of the listeners.
Yeah.
Ryan used to defend us.
It's a bit of a guilty pleasure, say what you will. But this Snow White, I feel like I'd be on a similar page. I doubt I'd like it. Everything I've seen so far tells me I probably would not like this movie, but I highly doubt I'd give it a 1 out of 10. How bad does it have to be a 1 out of 10 movie?
I've watched a lot of bad things, and I've never seen something that bad.
Yeah. I feel like some of the lowest I've ever seen are like, okay, 4 out of 10. Like 1 out of 10 movies are like the stuff we made in high school 10 years ago. And even we weren't that bad. Like some other people in a similar way, maybe. I just mean like no budget, no experience people make 1 out of 10 movies. stuff with zero redeeming quality. Although I still don't understand how they blew 240 to 270 million on this thing.
It's called Hollywood accounting.
Yes,
it's a very common practice of, yes, I will loan my company that I own as the director will loan my production, the money at a 50% interest rate. And that goes, whoop. You know, there's actually a huge history of lots of really big popular movies that made a ton of money that actually on the books lost money.
I feel like I've read that's most major movies for the last 30 years, at least.
I think the biggest one that I heard was like Return of the Jedi.
Oh, yeah.
Lost money. Return of the Jedi lost money. Really?
In theaters and in all the DVD sales and all the, like, really? That movie's still being watched 40 years later, but it's still unprofitable somehow. Anyway, so yeah, all this to say, I think the Snow White debacle is unfair. I think it's just hateful review bombing for a movie that nobody wanted to like in the first place. It never had a fair shot. People made up their mind a long time ago that this thing was not for them.
Who knows? Maybe one day it'll be a cult classic.
Maybe. Now, mind you, the reason I never went to see it is because I have a bit of a gripe with all of these live action remakes. I think they're unnecessary cash grabs that I would never choose over the original animated classics of these IPs. So I'm trying not to be a hypocrite and just be consistent by not seeing it. It has nothing to do with the discourse around this movie, why I didn't go see it. I haven't seen any of these live action remakes.
I'm going to make you break that rule because you're going to go see Lilo and Stitch with me. You have to.
It's different if somebody makes me, but if
I'm making you. I'm going to say it's your job for the podcast. You have to.
That's true. But on my own volition, I don't make a habit of seeing these things.
I will say there's so many of them that pop up that I'm like, are they actually doing that? Or is this like, you know, some fan edit or what is this? Like, I was like, oh, they're making a live action How to Train Your Dragon. This looks like a fan poster or something. I don't know. And then we were walking through the movie theater after Novocaine. I'm like, what the heck? They're actually making that? Huh? And it's coming out soon?
And then they load it so full of CGI anyway. I'm like, well, what's the point? You're not exactly
making the worst part. How to Train Your Dragon is already 3D animation. It's already mostly CGI.
I still think one of the worst ones was The Lion King, and they just did a Mufasa prequel. I'm like, okay, so you want more realistic CGI animals? I'd rather just watch the cartoon versions. It's more pleasing to look at.
I watched the first minute and a half of The Little Mermaid remake just to see how bad it would be. The first minute and a half, there's not a single live action shot. It's just CGI.
Yeah, right.
It's so bad.
I don't know. Disney can do what it wants, but I'm not paying for that.
I mean, it's not for us anyways.
I don't even know who it's supposed to be for. If I'm somebody showing somebody these movies for the first time, I'm just picking the original. I'm not spending $30 at a theater just to, even more probably if I'm taking somebody else, to show somebody this for the first time. It's not worth it.
I'll see.
Get a subscription to Disney Plus. A whole month's worth of subscription to Disney Plus just to see one classic movie is still more worth your money than seeing Snow White at a theater.
Yeah. The best one that most people actually thoroughly dislike was the Mulan remake. And they're like, it's nothing like the animated one. But then there's me and I'm like, wow, it's a lot closer to the original, like, original story, the non-Disney story. It was actually really good. I enjoyed it. I'd never seen the original Disney one, and then I was forced to watch that afterwards because I was told that it's like, no, it's so bad because it's not like this at all. And I was like,
well, what I've heard about that one, without getting too far into the weeds just for time purposes, but the big gripe I've heard about that one was just the same gripe I've heard about a lot of movies lately, which is that the main protagonist doesn't have to try for any of their powers. In the original Mulan, the whole point was she had to work to get respect. And in the new Mulan, oh, she's just born that good. And sorry, how dare you not? You don't respect her immediately.
I don't know. I think it's a time thing sometimes. Like, if we're talking about Rey, that's a different story. You built your story around that. For a one and done like Mulan, I think it's a time thing so that they don't have to, because there's no way you can believably build it up in that amount of time.
Right? The animation manage it. With probably less time. I don't know the run times, but I'll bet you the original Mulan movie was a shorter runtime than the live action one.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
It's about writing skill and efficiency. I think today's writers just don't know how to write efficiently or with any grounded character work. They just like perfect protagonists who they can shoehorn in and just be good.
No flaws.
No flaws. Nothing to aspire to, no character arcs for anybody, really. It's just, basically, these movies always go with, wow, you were perfect all along, and how didn't I see that sooner? Everybody else is wrong. The protagonist is always right, and everybody else has to see how special they were all along. That's the plot. Having not seen that one, but I've seen that plot enough times in recent movies. I think people are finally getting sick of that one, though. Anyway, so the last thing I wanted to talk about today was the Avengers Doomsday announcement. So apparently Marvel, I didn't watch it, but they did a 5-hour live stream to announce the cast for this movie, which was effectively just showing the backs of chairs with actors' names on it. They did this for 5 hours straight.
Wait, did they at least turn around? Were they in the chairs or?
I don't think so. I think it was just the chairs for 5 hours, and it got 275 million viewers by the time it was all done because people were like, holy, wait, they're still going? Wait, they're still going?
So nothing happened?
I think some things happened right at the end, but most of it was just showing the names of the actors for a comically long time just to make the internet be like, wait a minute, what's happening here? This is still going on. And it was so long, it drew a lot of interest.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So do you want to hear the list?
Yes, let's do it.
I'll comment on,
do they have who they're playing?
Yes. Okay. I'll comment on each of these if I have comments to make. Chris Hemsworth as Thor, which, cool. Glad to see him back after Love and Thunder. Maybe he'll get a shot at redemption here. This is the only representation I see by an original Avenger on this list.
He's been consistently good, so I'm glad he's back.
So we got Vanessa Kirby as Invisible Woman, which, sure, her movie's coming out. You're bringing Invisible Woman in the Avengers. Doomsday, cool.
So at least they're keeping the same cast for that.
Anthony Mackie, Captain America. Makes sense.
Okay.
Sure. Sebastian Stan, Winter Soldier. Okie dokie. Letitia Wright is Shuri / Black Panther. Paul Rudd, Ant-Man.
Yeah, Ant-Man.
Wyatt Russell, U.S. Agent. John Walker.
Oh, okay.
Tenakarta Mejia is Namor. He was in Black Panther 2, which you didn't see. So, interesting they're bringing Namor back, though. I don't know what he will do on an Avengers cast, but fine. Eben Moss-Bacharach, The Thing. So another Fantastic Four. Simu Liu is Shang-Chi.
Yeah.
Good to see him back. Florence Pugh is Yelena. Now here's where it starts to get a little interesting. Kelsey Grammer is Beast.
That's right. They teased that in the Marvels.
Yeah. Lewis Pullman as Sentry. I don't know who that is. That must be on one of the things I haven't seen. Danny Ramirez as Falcon, which I think in Brave New World, he was Falcon's sidekick, but he was Captain America's sidekick as the new Falcon, but I haven't seen that either.
Interesting.
Joseph Quinn is the Human Torch. David Harbour, Red Guardian. Winston Duke, M'Baku. Hannah John came in as Ghost. So basically they're getting the cast.
Who's Ghost?
She was the villain of Ant-Man and the Wasp. And she's also going to be in the Thunderbolts.
Oh, she's still around. Okay.
She's still around. Tom Hiddleston is Loki.
What? All right.
And here's a...
Wait. Which Loki?
I'm going to assume the main one.
But the main one's dead, isn't he?
No, he's just in Yggdrasil.
No. That's...
Oh, sorry. That's the TV show one.
I was going to say, because the only one we have is the main timeline. He's dead.
I'm going to assume TVA Loki. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Now listen to this string. This one's interesting. Patrick Stewart, Professor X. Ian McKellen, Magneto. Alan Cumming, Nightcrawler. Rebecca Romijn, Mystique. James Marsden, Cyclops. Channing Tatum, Gambit.
Okay.
That is the most interesting string out of all these.
All the originals, basically, right?
I'll finish up and then we can double back on that. Okay. Then at the end, we have Pedro Pascal, Mr. Fantastic, and Robert Downey Jr.'s Doctor Doom.
Okay, that's an interesting one.
You didn't hear about that cast. That casting was already announced previously. It is Avengers Doomsday, which, if you didn't know, that movie was originally going to be Kang Dynasty, and then all the drama with Jonathan Majors happened, and he got fired, and then they said, okay, we're just doing a Doctor Doom.
Well, I guess it makes sense to have Fantastic Four, then.
So basically, this movie is like whoever was left of the Avengers after Civil War and Endgame, the Thunderbolts movie, then kind of the Black Panther universe as well, the new Fantastic Four, and... for some reason, a lot of the original X-Men. Which is very interesting.
I'm gonna guess because they introduced the... Did they say Monica Rambeau is gonna be in it?
I did not see her name on the list here.
My theory would be is that they're playing off of the end of the Marvels where they actually had Kelsey Grammer back and introduced a split in the timeline.
Okay.
She's technically in... an alternate timeline where that... So I'm going to guess that that's the original X-Men universe.
Okay.
And they're going to... and they're, whatever's going to happen, maybe it'll be their version of Doctor Doom. I don't know how the crossover is going to work, though. But they've already established that at least Kelsey Grammer's Beast is in that universe.
Right. I think it's interesting that there's no... Monica Rambeau or Brie Larson as Captain Marvel either.
I bet you at least one of them is going to show up. It's just not going to be announced because then people are going to guess
right
what the story is going to be.
Because this is supposed to be a two-parter. It's going to be Avengers Doomsday, and then in 2027, they're doing Secret Wars. And I think the events of Doomsday are... So we're getting two Avengers movies in 2 years, and they're supposed to go next to each other, back-to-back. Which... you're right. Maybe they're saving some people for the next one, or they're going to cameo in Doomsday.
It'll be a secret.
Because there are a couple people missing here. Which, I just think it blows my mind to see that they're bringing the other X-Men back. Which, not that I was disappointed with all the cameos we got in Deadpool and Wolverine, but I was really hoping to see these guys back, basically. Some of these particular ones. I really wanted to see Ian McKellen get one more shot at Magneto because he hasn't done that since Days of Future Past.
Maybe they're busy. They're busy, that's why.
Maybe.
Busy filming the new one. I mean, if they're promoting it already, they must already be shooting. Like, it must be...
I believe so.
...shooting.
I'm especially excited for James Marsden as Cyclops because I'm a big fan of James Marsden and always thought he got a... raw deal in those old movies, got super overshadowed by Hugh Jackman, despite Cyclops having to be it being the traditional team leader. So I'd love to see him get another shot. And, you know, other characters like Nightcrawler and Mystique. I'm like, wow, Rebecca Romijn's back as Mystique. That's cool. She's doing really good work on Strange New Worlds right now. That's where she's been lately. But I'd like... Mystique is what I knew her from in my childhood, and... that'll be cool.
Maybe it won't be TVA Loki.
Who knows?
If we're talking about, you know, the X-Men universe, maybe there is a Loki in that universe. We already know that there are lots of Lokis, but...
We don't even know if Fantastic Four is in the mainline universe.
Probably not.
Because based on the trailer and the visual style of it, it looks like it's in an alternate universe.
Listen, the Baxter Building isn't there in every Avengers movie.
Look, what I will say is this is an opportunity to finally pay off all these disparate threads of multiverse BS that have been going on for the last 7 years. Yeah.
Everything back to the sacred timeline.
I don't know about that, but it seems to finally be paying off all the multiverse stuff, which, you know what, you got my attention with this cast list. Let's see where it goes. I don't know if it's going to be good, but you interested me, at the very least. So.
I mean, at least taking Robert Downey Jr. as Dr. Doom is actually using the multiverse the way I thought they would.
The way I, nay, I fear, I fear, I fear they would. Yeah. That could go either way.
I don't like what they've done with the multiverse.
I've never been a fan of the multiverse concept to start. It barely worked. The reason people, I think the reason comics as an industry, specifically Marvel and DC, have been dying in the mainstream for the last 30 years is because of the over-reliance on stuff like multiverse crap. Like, I thought the movies were a perfect chance to finally, sacred timeline sort of idea of this is the one and done story of all these characters and however they play out. This is the story of the Marvel Universe. And then you add in multiverse and suddenly everything became as convoluted as comics. And lo and behold, even people who have been following this since 2008 aren't catching up on everything anymore because it's gone so far out of the purview of things I'm interested in and got so convoluted I can't keep up anymore. I don't know who's, like, you're talking about all this stuff in Captain Marvel too. That's interesting. That's bringing up stuff in the multiverse. I'm like, I've got no idea. I don't know what Kelsey Grammer's beast has to do with Captain Marvel.
Okay, but look at Brave New World. That's not multiverse. Nobody went to see it anyways.
Yeah.
That's the thing. They've gone stale on the main timeline. So to me, this is where I expected the multiverse to go. Not these, like, half-assed multiverse. Like, they're going all the way with it. And you're going to Elseworld stories, essentially. Which
I'm
is
fine
what
with that.
I expected from multiverse. That's what I wanted to see from multiverse. Is essentially, you know, we're not in this golden timeline anymore. You don't have to watch all of these anymore. Let's just see these characters. Let's throw scenarios around and see what happens.
Which is the fun way to do it, for sure. That's my preferred version of Multiverse 2 is Elseworlds.
Besides, we'll probably get to see a super vain Tony Stark again. Because he'll be like, no, I'm too ugly. I need the mask. I really hope it's not the Doctor Doom where he's actually messed up. I hope it's the Doctor Doom where he's like super handsome and he's like, no, I need the mask.
That'd be an interesting play on it.
That would be awesome.
Well, anyway, I do have some half-hearted hope for this. Marvel's track record hasn't been great the last 7 years, but, you know, I do still follow every so often stuff they're doing. So, yeah, that's what's new in the media industry and what we've seen lately. So, yeah, tried out something new. Where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm.
And you can find me on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. And check out ThoughtPlane.ca for everything else I do. You can even donate a buck or two there if you like our work and you're feeling generous. Buy us a candy bar. And we hope to see you on the next close-up with Ryan and Joe, where we give you another new version of Leisure List. Till next time.
Take care.